I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about 21st century farming in Indiana. We're going to talk about what has changed about farming and what hasn't. We're going to talk about the challenges and the needs for farmers in the second decade of this century. I'll be talking today with guests who, pardon the pun, know the field. Indiana Agriculture Commissioner Gina Sheets, Indiana Farm Bureau Vice President and Evansville farmer Randy Crone, and Hendricks County farmer David Harden. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
Support for No Limits is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about 21st century farming in Indiana. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Got some great guests today. I'm going to start with Gina Sheets, who is Indiana Agriculture Commissioner. Gina, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. Happy to be here.
It's good to have you here. Randy Crone, who is an Indiana Farm Bureau Vice President and an Evansville farmer. Randy, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, John. Happy to be here.
It's good to have you here as well. And David Harden, who is a Hendricks County farmer. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John. Very glad to be part of the show.
Well, I'm going to start with you, Gina, just to give us some perspective about why farming is so important to this state. Could you talk a little bit about the economic impact, how it contributes to the state's well-being, other than the fact that we all get to eat?
Definitely happy to do that. And you know, that's important. Not only do we get to eat, but we have clothing and we drive on the roads every day. So we look at that as Indiana is a leader in the global atmosphere, so the global arena in cultivation and innovation of food, fuel, feed, and fiber. It's roughly a $26 billion economy to the state of Indiana. And if you do some extrapolation, jobs based on jobs that come off of that, you are quickly approaching a $38 billion impact to the state economy. And the job sector, you can measure that many different ways. At ISDA, we measure that using the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it's roughly 490,000 jobs to the state of Indiana related to, directly and indirectly, to agriculture.
I think if I'm a listener out there and I hear $26 billion, $38 billion, that's slightly more than pocket change. So to put it in some kind of perspective, what percentage of Indiana's economy is that?
Roughly, when you look at workforce, it's about 17% of the workforce, and on a manufacturing component, it's the fourth largest area
The state's economic growth. Well, Randy, in terms of issues that are important to farmers right now, what are the big ones?
Well, I think right now what we're looking at is what's happening in Washington, D.C. would be with the Farm Bill is one of the issues that is going on.
Yeah, we've already gotten a question from a listener about that.
Okay.
Go ahead, answer.
So,
anticipate the question.
Farmers, I mean, the world's changed quite a bit in agriculture in the last 30, 40 years. You're well aware of, and I'm sure your listeners are too. But having some certainty and some security about agriculture is very important. So Farm Bill is probably one of them that's just upmost and top of mind right now.
Why is that so important?
Because I think, like I said, the world of agriculture has changed, but the dollars that are at stake, when I started farming in 1983, the dollars that it took to put out an acre of corn were probably around $100 an acre. Now you're talking, you're approaching $400 an acre. So there's a lot more capital at risk, and farmers are looking for a little bit of a safety net to be sure, because there's so many things that you don't control, whether, you know, it's Mother Nature, the politics, the political side in Washington, D.C., trade issues. There's so many things that you can't control yourself that outside is will decide your profitability of your farm. So the farm bill is one of the top, and I mean, if I'm what I'm concerned about is how do we come out in this bill now?
David Harden, and I'm not going to out. Well, I think that Randy mentioned he's been farming since 1983, so you can do the math and figure out. He has to be at least 30 and a little more than that. you though are somewhat younger than that. How did you come to decide you wanted to farm, that you wanted that to be your living?
Well, John, I grew up on our family farm, and I think I always knew I wanted to have a career or a life in food production. Until I went to college, I didn't know whether that meant being back on our family farm or, you know, working off farm, but staying within the industry. When I was in college, I decided, yes, the family farm was where I wanted to be, but I took a few years after I graduated from college, got a master's degree, worked at a few other places before I came back, but, you know, we'll do the math, but I came back full-time to our family farm in 2003, so only 20 years after Randy.
Well, and what You went to college and you knew you wanted, what did you study? I mean, and I want to get at what are the things that a farmer needs to know now to be successful?
Yes, my undergraduate major was in animal science, so I learned everything about the life cycle and physiology of domestic livestock. And then I told you I went out and got a graduate degree, you know, farming is a lifestyle choice, but it's also a business. I got a MBA in marketing from DePaul in Chicago to help me, you know, understand the financial aspects of our business and be able to run it as such.
We are talking about 21st century farming here in Indiana. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Roger, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I would like to ask any of the three what Indiana is doing about prime farmland preservation. And the reason I ask that question is I have in front of me 1978 documents that one of your guests will appreciate, I think, Randy. It says a land use newsletter by Gary Steinhardt, extension agent from Purdue. That was back in 78. And then we can move up to 79. He continued that letter for a while. And then we go to the mid-80s and the Thicker publication that they put out. I think you get the gist of my thing. The last one I have here is Governor Frank O'Bannon, members of the Indiana General Assembly, Hoosier Farmland Preservation Task Force. I'll let your guests take it from there.
Great. Thank you very much. Well, we'll start with Gina on that one. You know, what about the preservation of prime farmland? A, what is the issue there for those for people who aren't farmers, and B, what's the situation then?
So the issue is looking at the opportunity to ensure that we continue to have farm ground and which to be productive on, as folks in the communities and larger cities in particular are looking to get out of that environment and move out into a countryside or definitely a less population. And as talk about the terminology of urban sprawl. Mm-hmm. So how do you work with communities? And that's exactly one of the positions that ISDA has, or sectors that we have, is advocacy. And under advocacy is policy, development, zoning issues. We don't ever go into a county uninvited, but when a county is looking at their local zoning ordinances and trying to figure out a green space, so here are our city boundaries, and here is our farm ground and countryside. What is the best use of land? And so we'll come in and sit down and talk about those best uses along with our friends from Farm Bureau, we also have a lot of partners out in the field, the Indiana Land Resources Council, for example, which is an appointed council made up of a variety of folks who we meet together on a quarterly basis, and that's exactly what we are looking at, what's going on in annexation issues, what's going on in water issues, all of those things, so that we are being proactive and being informed in the decisions that we make.
How real a danger is this? Because, you know, if you drive north of Indianapolis, for example, and I'm sure we can, Roger was calling from Crown Point, almost any area in the state will have metropolitan area. If you go north of Indianapolis on, say, Spring Mill Road or Township Line or something like that, you know, 20, 25 years ago, a lot of that land, you didn't have to go very far north of 86th Street, and you were driving past cornfields. Now you're driving through subdivisions. Presumably there were farms that disappeared to create those subdivisions. How big a concern is that? I'll start with Gina, but then go to Randy on that one.
Well, I think it's a big concern, not only in the state of Indiana, but across the country. As the song would go, they've paved paradise and put up a parking lot. Mm-hmm. And the other piece
Thank
to
you, Johnny
the
Mitchell.
The other piece to that is, you know, there is a business, as David pointed out, and there's a value to that landowner to look at their own future and their own use of their lifestyle and what they are going to be doing. And so while we want to protect the farm ground and ensure that that's available for the next generation, there are also landowners there that are ready to sell.
Is that a challenge? I mean, I would think farming's not an effortless lifestyle or career choice. At some point you begin to think, rather than raising corn or whatever, I can make more money just selling to this developer.
I think when you look at it, a lot of farmers, if you work in private industry, you'll have a 401k. Farmers' 401k is typically their farmland, and that's mm-hmm. part of the issue. I have concerns when I live north of Evansville and I see the development moving toward us. Our farm's been in the family 135 years. It's not for sale. But if a developer comes and a generation or two farther, it's a private property rights issue. How do you tell them, no, you can't sell it and develop it or make a shopping mall? But I think we need to be smart about how we do the development and be sure we're using the ground for the best use. Maybe don't use the most productive ground that could be growing corn or soybeans or other crops. Try to find the more marginal acres to do development on and use it very smartly. It bothers me when I see a lot of individuals move out of the city and they want to have 5 or 10 acres, excuse me, and that comes out of production and it's a yard, or, you know, maybe it might be a small hobby farm, but most likely 5 acres in its yard. If they were on a half an acre or an acre, you could keep a lot more ground in production. So I think we need to be smart about how we do development. We need to really have plans, and that's where ISDA is looking at it. And I mean, I don't think you're going to stop it, and I understand the economics. You know, if somebody's offering you a lot of money for some ground, I can't blame them for taking it, but I don't want it in my area really either. So it's a double-edged sword, but we have to learn how to deal with it and manage it.
David, I would think to some degree this is an issue that you've got, because you are the youngest member of the panel here, and I don't want to make you feel, Randy's making faces at me here, but because of that, you've got a lot of time to project into the future here. Do some of these trends concern you, the rate of change in farming and the fact that land use is becoming an increasingly volatile issue in our political culture?
Absolutely, and I look at it from both sides. Being from Hendricks County, we are one of the donut counties for Indianapolis, so urban sprawl is something that we think about on a continual basis, because there are, you know, other uses for that land besides agriculture, be they housing developments or strip malls or whatnot, and that inflates, you know, either the purchase price of that land or what the cash rent value would be for that land. But, you know, I think the comment's already been made that, you know, development is not going to stop, but hopefully we can guide it and steer it in a manner that's that's productive, and we're the best, you know, land is being used for its best possible use. When I said that you're not going to be able to stop development, while we aren't on the original farm when our family moved to Indiana, they moved to central Indiana, started farming here in Marion County in 1827. The original farm was just a few miles from this studio. Obviously, that was turned
into a much better story if it was right here at the studio.
Yeah, it would have been a much shorter drive in this morning. But, you know, I think we just need to take the long view of these things and make sure that development is done in a proper manner.
We are talking about 21st century farming here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. My guests are farm experts Gina Sheets, Randy Crone, and David Harden. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about 21st century farming in Indiana. My guests are Gina Sheets, who is the Indiana Agriculture Commissioner, Randy Crone, an Indiana Farm Bureau Vice President and Evansville farmer, and David Harden, who is a Hendricks County farmer. We've gotten a couple of questions from a farmer who didn't want to go on the air. Says, why is there a need for an ag gag bill? It failed, but it's being studied by lawmakers this summer, and I'm going to ask what the Farm Bureau's position was on that. I'm going to start with you, with Randy.
You have to understand a little the background about this. I think it was cast in a little bit of a negative light, but if you go back, the issue is part of it started on an Ohio dairy farm where they had an employee that videotaped some actions that were happening, and I don't think any farmer, any livestock person would be supportive of what they did. They would be opposed to it. But what happened is they found out the video was actually paid for by a animal rights group that wanted, staged it and had it paid for. So the intent of this bill was to stop things like that, not to stop people from, you know, if there are bad actors, and I think David's a livestock or a hog farmer, I mean, if there's bad actors, we want them stopped, we want them out of business. And that's Farm Bureau's position, and I think any farmer's position would say, we do not condone bad actors. But the whole concept behind that bill was to keep ones from being paid to stage events on farms that don't really happen. But once it hits YouTube and you know the media, how the mass media or with all what's out there, YouTube, different things, it spreads really fast. And you can't put the information underneath there that this isn't actually what happens.
Well, although I think one of the criticisms on the other side of it was there are remedies in that case. That's why there are libel laws. That's why there are ways, if it's not an accurate portrayal and these are not public figures, then chances are there's a way to resolve that. Do you support, then, an ag gag bill bringing it back? Or
one, I wouldn't call it an ag gag bill because connotation of that seems really negative. We need to find a way to make sure that the things are represented. There are ways to act on that. But once a video like that's out, it spreads so fast. It's the negative impact of what happens to a lot of other, whether it's dairy or livestock farmers, that it's hard to roll that back. So somewhere, there is a happy medium here somewhere that we need to work on and figure out how to prevent actions like that, but not be able to protect the bad actors.
We are talking about 21st century farming in Indiana. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Doug, welcome to the program.
How are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a degree in urban planning, and I know a big issue is when a lot of these counties try to go out and create a comprehensive plan to limit and to control development, You then turn around and have farmers and other people in the community that put signs out that say, don't let the government tell us what to do with our land. So here they try to go out and do something about this and be proactive about the development, but then to turn around and have some of the same people, you know, kind of come back at them with, well, don't tell me what to do with my land.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Doug. Well, I'll throw that one to David here. I think Doug's point really is this can be a two-edged sword here. It can cut both ways. Is there a challenge, and I think Randy had alluded to that earlier, that he doesn't want to be in a position of telling anyone what to do, but if we're saying that there's got to be planning and we've got to determine what the best land use is, that assumes some sort of government oversight.
I think that's a very fair statement, and I think he made a good point. You know, it's very rare that you can put more than two farmers in a room together and expect to get the same opinion on any subject out of them. Before I came back to our family farm, I lived in DuPage County, Illinois for a while, and I saw where they had the benefits of good comprehensive planning where agriculture and urban development were able to coexist and it was very well planned. But at the same point in time, if I had somebody coming to me and tell me that, you know, my farm was going to be zoned a certain way, I might not like that either if it wasn't how I thought it should be developed. You know, Randy really made the point very well before that a lot of farmers, 401k is their land. Mm-hmm. And if you come in and say, and they may have been banking on the fact that they were going to be able to sell off parcels of that to fund their retirement, and they may have been banking on that for 40 years. And if you come in and say, we're not going to allow you to do that anymore, you can see why that's going to get somebody upset.
Is there... To some degree, we're talking about how issues of really how the land should be used, and it gets tied up. I mean, we've talked economics so far, but you've both alluded to the fact that there's more to it here. I mean, you're both working family farms, so there's emotion involved, too. Does that make, you know, determining what the policies should be that much more difficult? Gina, maybe as the one who's not intimately invested in this, you're the best one to throw that to.
Well, sure, but I do live on a farm. But also, in my previous life, I was director of economic development. So I've seen both sides of the issue. As Doug was pointing out, you know, you have the farmer issue where all of a sudden we're looking at an industrial park and new zoning of land that's always been used as farm ground that sits right next to an industrial park that we're going to change it to an I-1 classification. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I've seen
communities. What's an I-1 classification?
Industrial, a very basic industrial use. So you can build some particular types of manufacturing can go onto that location. And at the same time, I've seen communities in the middle of downtowns or two or three blocks off that don't want the newest, greatest superstore going in or big boxed situation. So I've seen, but yet we want economic growth and we want that type of impact. I think when we're talking about planning, in particular out into the rural areas, tracking, selling off, a farmer being able to sell off 1 acre of ground so that someone in the family can put a house to there. And by the way, it's down a gravel road, and now you need a school bus to come down that gravel road. There are other things that we need to think about that cost additional services. And so that's where good planning comes into effect.
We are talking about 21st century farming here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Ben, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
We've been talking a lot about land use, but I kind of wanted to ask about water use. I know moving into, 21st century farming, one of the things that is really straining the agriculture industry is sort of a limited water supply. In a lot of areas, we're bleeding our aquifers faster than they can replenish. And so I'm wondering if there's been any thought put into how to go about sustainable water use and sustainable water management, and what might be on the horizon in that front. So I appreciate you taking my call.
Certainly. Thanks very much for the question. Well, who would like to take that one first? Gina, maybe is a policy?
Sure. We actually, that is a discussion, certainly not this year, but last year water use was a topic of discussion when we were looking at drought issues. And depending on what part of the state, it's more important. When you talk about irrigation and being able to irrigate and you're using a pivot system, which definitely comes from a well, what impact does that have on the neighbors? And it's the same thing, again, looking at just basic economic manufacturing development when you're locating a new industry to your community. And by the way, they're going to pull out 20,000 gallons of water per minute. How does that affect the rest of the community and the water tower? So that always is an issue of conversation. I would say in Indiana, again, site specific doesn't fit into this, but the broad brush is that we are concerned about water, water runoff, and the quality of water issues. We do address that on our level.
You said that some parts of the state it's a bigger issue than others. What parts of the state is it a bigger issue?
Well, I'll let Randy talk about that because he's in that area.
I'm in the southwest part, and actually on our farm we have 7 center pivot irrigators. And
I probably ought to explain for non-farmers what those are.
They're the machines that go around in a circle and will spray water. You see them as you go down the highway, but we have 7 of them. About a third of our ground, a little over a third of our ground, is irrigated. In a year like last year, it was crucial. Without those irrigators, we would have been in major, major trouble. We would have had total crop failures. And one, it saved us economically probably or financially by having those. But also, you know, it's important, where do we use the water? It's a good debate we have to have, but having an abundant food supply, or at least enough of a food supply, those irrigators around this country helped last year in a year that was, you know, a major drought. Or one in 1988, I believe, was the last really major drought. So, but we're blessed where we're at, that we're on a very good water aquifer. Our water table only dropped about 1.5 feet all of last summer, so we're very blessed. We can run all the irrigators and not have problems with it, but not everybody across the state is that lucky.
We've gotten an email question from regular listener Jerry, and if you want to send a question to us via email, you can do so by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry's question is, your guests have alluded to the political aspects of farming. What are the 2 or 3 political issues of most concern to Hoosier farmers? Randy, I'll keep that one with you.
Okay, the one, I guess, comes to mind right now, which they're debating today, is the Farm Bill. But it's probably the lack of understanding of agriculture in the political world, whether it's here at the State House. We're pretty lucky that most of our legislators here in Indianapolis have a somewhat grasp of agriculture. There's some in there. But when we get to D.C., most of our legislators are so far removed from agriculture, it's hard for them to understand what we do, why we do, and how their decisions will impact us, whether it's trade issues. You know, that can make a big impact on market price. So whether the Farm Bill and having a security safety net. After last year, I know several young farmers that told me if they wouldn't have had crop insurance, they would not have been in business this year. They couldn't have survived financially. So having a good safety net underneath is very, very important.
Well, David, you're doing this as well. What is... What's the thing that keeps you up at night, that you worry about, the biggest fear or challenge confronting farmers today?
Well, I have a laundry list as long as my arm. I wish it was just one thing, John.
Well, give me the top 5. Okay.
For me, it's market volatility, and as has been mentioned here today, there's so many aspects that play into that are outside of our control. You know, it depends upon what the Chinese economy is doing, what the weather's like in Brazil, and then government regulatory issues, whether they be on what and when I can apply herbicide to my crops, or how I am to handle and when I'm to do certain production practices with my livestock. You know, we farmers have always tried to use, before it was a term that was in vogue, you know, use best management practices. You know, we want to take care of our animals and take care of the land, because that is our livelihood. If we don't take care of it, it's not going to take care of us.
Well, that you're speaking to the fact that there's a tremendous complexity, and you're tied in. Most people think of farming, and the romantic vision is that, you know, it is a way to get away from those issues and complexity, and that's clearly not the case. Randy, I'm going to ask, because I think it gets to really the heart of this program, and this topic, since you've been farming now, you're entering, I'm presuming, your fourth decade now. Just starting your fourth decade. That's what I'm saying, though. What's the biggest way that farming has changed?
I was just talking about this with an individual this morning. In my 30-some years, I mean, the technology that we use, I remember several things. There's a lot of things that come to mind here. The size of the farms, because the margins are so small, you have to grow your farm. And I know some think, well, they want a lot of smaller farms. That's great if you can make a living off of it. So having to grow your farm, the management side, technology side, you know, we've got auto steering, we've got variable rate seeding, we've got planters that, you know, with the GPS look at that, and I can map our fields and see exactly where the better soils are and the poorer soils, and the planter will change the population that we plant out there according to the soil types. Same way with fertility. So it's the technology side that what I've seen in the last 30 years has ramped up, and we've been able to make better use of the ground. We're used to, you just kind of took the average of everything. Now we're trying to maximize what we can get out of it with good technology and the fertility, but it's so expensive on the fertility side, we don't want to put any extra on, so we tweak it, I'd call it prescription farming, really.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Quinn who says, what is being done in agriculture today to address issues of sustainability, soil health, and overall environmental concerns caused by modern agriculture? I'll throw that one to you, Gina.
Sure, and actually it goes back almost hand in hand with what Jerry was talking about, or the question that Jerry asked. For farmers today, what we talk about a lot at ISDA are the regulatory issues. And in ISDA, we have very specific folks dedicated to water quality, nutrient management, looking at ensuring that what we are putting on our soils, what's happening underneath, so the substrate, how that's impacting the plant, and what the water runoff and the water quality looks like. That's definitely an issue for us. And the other issues that were mentioned, licensing. That continues to be an issue for us. And then market access. A lot of people are wanting local foods into the school system or more access to that. And that's not as easy because of permitting and licensing that needs to be done just to say, okay, we want more local food into our school system. So those things, and then I think that goes to her question.
Well, we've got the local food movement, and we've also got the organic foods as they become more popular. That was another email question we got that says, are we seeing more Hoosier producers farm organically now? Gina, I'll throw that one to you as well.
One of the things that we've been able to do as a federal government pass-through with dollars is support the certification of organic farms in the state of Indiana to the tune of about $68,000 to $70,000 a year to help producers who choose to do that become licensed and certified. And so we are seeing a somewhat of an increase through that. That's a three-year process. People need to remember that. The year that you decide to do it, you're not going to be certified organic to be in production right away. And yeah,
how complicated a process is it?
It's a complicated process. You have to be able to showcase what the history of the ground that you are using. First of all, you need to know what's taken place in that ground, and then you need to go and showcase what you are doing on that ground. Everything from what you are putting on the plants, certainly, but what you're putting in the soil, the water, you need to know your water content and quality of your water, and then how you are handling that that product.
We are talking about 21st century farming in Indiana with my guests Gina Sheets, Randy Crone, David Harden. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about 21st century farming in Indiana. My guests are Gina Sheets, who is Indiana Agriculture Commissioner, Randy Crone, who's an Indiana Farm Bureau Vice President and a farmer from Evansville, and David Harden, who is a Hendricks County farmer. Carl, welcome to the program.
Hello. I have a question about this genetic modifications on food products. That Monsanto has been, 90% of the, 90-95% of the seeds are produced by Monsanto, and now it turns out they're dangerous. They're destroying the land, and I wonder how you guys are going to change to replace that product without modified seed.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Carl. Well, I'll throw that one first to Randy.
Okay, I guess I'm not convinced that they're destroying the land right now is the first thing, because before any of these seeds are brought to market, it goes through some extreme testing and certification, whether it's here in the U.S. or other countries. And most of them that we have been approved in all the major markets that we do business in. But that has changed the world. It does make us produce, it allows us to produce a lot more corn, bushels per acre. We're able to produce more per acre off of our ground, which also will help on the price-wise. If you're hungry in one of these foreign countries, we were talking about organics. That's great if you have the money, if you have the financial ability to buy those and pay more for them. But I think if you're in some of these other countries where you're earning a dollar or two a day, they're going to be looking for the cheapest food product to keep them alive. And I think the GM products are a very important asset to the U.S. farmer and to people all around the country.
How much of this, Gina, though, is a product of the fact that people have different thresholds for the level of, and particularly since, as we've established in the first 40 minutes of this program, farming is now very political now, too. It is a hot button. People are throwing massive amounts of money at attempting to influence public policy in regard to agriculture. There's a pretty intense lobbying bill going on about the farm bill right now. How much of that is that these folks, A, don't necessarily trust the process to protect their interests, and they feel like they've got perhaps a higher standard than the industry might have as to what they want to consume?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a choice, and there are lots of opportunities when a consumer goes to a store to have that choice on what they are purchasing and what they are taking home to prepare for their family. And being supportive of that choice in all sectors, understanding that you begin with the end in mind, so that an organic farmer begins with the end in mind of having that niche market. And when we are looking at producing food on a global market, as Randy said, it's being able to produce that so that we keep costs down, so that it is an affordable in the marketplace. It's critical. And the other thing of when we talk about GMOs, I think there's an understanding of, for example, we want big, beautiful red tomatoes, and we want that consistently. Well, there is the heritage line of tomato seeds that you can go out and find and plant, but there is a lot of technology in taking the best of the best of those tomatoes to get to that perfect tomato. So I think sometimes as consumers we forget exactly what genetic modified means.
John,
yes,
if,
David,
if you
please.
Don't mind me adding in here, one of the things that a lot of people don't understand about or may not be informed about with genetically modified crops, these crops are designed to target specific pests. I don't know many people that are too upset that there are fewer corn rootworm beetles in the world. And because these crops have been changed to target these specific pests, we're having to apply much reduced rates of herbicides and insecticides to our fields. So if that's something that, you know, people are worried about what we're putting into the environment, we have reduced dramatically the amount of things that we're putting in there. And, you know, we live in a free market society. If people want the ability, as Gina said, to pay for a differentiated product, they're more than welcome to. On our farm, we raise both genetically modified crops and non-GM corn that goes specifically for cornflakes in Europe, where they're not as accepting of the technology. We have to use a different management practice with that grain, but the price allows us to be able to, that we're compensated with, allows us to be able to do that.
What's the difference in the price?
Well, contractually, I'm not allowed to say, but it makes up for the extra hurdles of not just how we treat the crop, but how we segregate it, how we store it, and how we handle it.
It's identity preserved is what it is. So it's the management that goes into it to keep it. The grain bins have to, you have to, we grow some non-GM corn, soybeans, and you have to clean the bins, clean your combine, and you have to certify different things that it has identity preserved. So when it shows up at the elevator at the port, the final destination, they know we sign affidavits about what was growing in this field and what we did to it.
We are talking about 21st century farming here on No Limits. If you want to send us an email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. We got an email from a listener named Elizabeth, wanted to talk about the ag gag bill. And basically, you can tell it is an issue of importance to her. Says, don't let them off the hook on this issue. I'm going to summarize this in the interest of time, saying consumers are becoming a lot smarter about food today, and it's more a challenge directly to, I think, Randy, your position. She concludes by saying, if people saw the suffering animals endured in these settings, they'd stop buying meat. Why is the Farm Bureau not advising farmers to phase out customary cruel practices and be transparent in doing business rather than supporting corporate industrial farms buying or using restrictive legislation which impedes on our right to free speech and public safety?
Okay, I'm not a livestock producer, but I know David is, and I have a lot of friends that raise pork and beef, and I can guarantee you the passion that they have raising those animals, they are not mistreated. They are taken care of. There's reasons they've put them in buildings. If you go back 50 years ago, they were free range, but then you also had coyotes chasing them down and killing them. They were out when it was 0 or 20 below. They were out in that cold weather. Now, would you rather be in 20 below zero weather, or would you rather be in a barn like David has and temperature controlled? You control the diseases because everything, I mean, he doesn't let anybody on his farm just walk in there because he's worried about diseases. If he doesn't take care of his animals, they won't take care of him, and it's the bottom line. It's a way of life, I think David said, but you won't convince me. Maybe there are a few bad actors, but 99% of the farmers truly, truly care about their animals, and they do what they need to do. And they, you know, at the end, hopefully they make a profit at it because it is a business, but they believe in what they're doing, and they're not mistreated. If any animal's mistreated, your rate of gain is going to be lower, and they won't grow as fast, and David can probably testify to this a little better than I can, but I have a very, very hard time when somebody tells me that animals are being mistreated, because they are not.
Does the Farm Bureau, to get to Elizabeth's question, though, police the bad actors? I mean, you've talked about how you don't want to protect them. Is there some mechanism in place for you to police them then?
I think that probably falls under with IDEM and BOA, Board of Animal Health, and some of those. But, I mean, we've seen, you've heard stories of bad actors around, and I think they try to take care of them. The Board of Animal Health will try to deal with them, and there are ways to do it. But just to throw everybody into one basket and say that everybody mistreats their animals, really, I'm not an animal we don't raise animals, but I have plenty of friends. They take care of them, and they care. And if something happens to them, it bothers them.
Well, can I just interject, which I mentioned earlier? The other component to this bill is the whole business side and manufacturing side that says you're not taking a video camera into the floor of Subaru, for example, mm-hmm. you know, a major business here in the state of Indiana, to videotape what's going on there. And you don't take it into restaurant kitchens to video. For some reason, when we talk about farming, we decide that it's not right to see what's going on behind the door, that's for employees only.
Well, although I guess the argument on the other side would be, if you're taking the camera in there to document an unsafe or unfair labor practice, then shouldn't there be some protection of the fact that you're catching people breaking the law?
And there should be, but are you making the assumption that every farmer is doing that? So that, you know, I don't think that's fair. We don't do that with businesses.
Well, and I don't want to argue the point because we do have callers here, but I guess what I would say is, if that's not occurring, then the video is not damaging, right?
Correct.
As long as it's not a staged thing that happened, which is what happened on a dairy farm that spread around very fast, but that, you know, just about killed that dairy farm and their reputation when it was not common practice of what they did. It was a matter of a couple of employees were paid to stage something. They videoed it and said it came from this farm.
We are talking about 21st century farming here on No Limits. Joe, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you, John. I appreciate being a part of the dialogue here. I'm from Rush County, which is southeast of Indianapolis, 40-ish miles. Pretty good corn, soybean area. And I lived in Wisconsin for a number of years in the 80s and 90s and came back here to find that the county commissioners have in place regulations that require people who want to buy rural country land to build homes on must purchase 40 acres, a minimum. And it seems really archaic, and I was kind of astounded by it when I first moved back here. But it kind of makes sense. You know, farmland goes for $4,000 or $5,000 an acre out here. So it's prohibitive to urban sprawl to come out this far from the donut. You know, you see people up around New Pal, and they build at will. And we got to remember that the creator only made so many acres. There's not going to be any more of them. So I'd like to address that. And, John, I also want to say I think you've opened up a whole can of worms that deserves a whole series of programs. GMOs can be one place, organic, sustainable, opposed to conventional, confinement feeding. There's a whole world of issues. But
well, we're not going away, so we'll have time to have those conversations.
I know, and I thank you for the time. I'd like to know what your folks think about that 40-acre thing.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the call, Joe.
Right.
I'll throw that one to Gina.
Sure. And first of all, Joel, I would say that Rush County is a very good partner in agriculture production and looking at ways to continue to be leaders in the state of Indiana in agriculture businesses. I'm not aware of the 40-acre rule. I do know a community that I live in, we had a 20-acre rule, and it was the example that I said earlier, that someone can't take 20 acres and carve out a little acre of it to build a home, and all of a sudden now we need a school bus to get down to that road. And on top of that, depending on how close that is to the city, and let's see if I can paint this picture very quickly, mm-hmm. you're going down a gravel road, and every quarter mile you have a driveway entrance, or maybe every tenth of a mile you just have one driveway entrance. And eventually that becomes a part of a suburban area. Now all of a sudden you have a high density, high traffic, high concern pattern area as that continues to be developed, versus if you're taking 100 acres or 40 acres, let's go back to Joel's example, you're taking that 40 acres and you're saying, all right, you need to put a planned unit development. Instead of piecing this off in 1-acre lots, let's put a whole 40 acres, so 40 lots, and do a planned unit versus single one right after another curb cutting.
We are talking about 21st century farming here in Indiana. Kate, welcome to the program.
Hi, yes, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Certainly. We're getting a little close on time, so if we can get to your question.
Okay. I do have a two-part question. I wanted to go back to the previous caller who was talking about water,
mm-hmm.
and I know Guy's Reservoir has a problem with, I believe it's the green algae strand, and it's a direct result of nitrogen from fertilizer being poured into this man-made lake, so there's no water being flushed into to clean out the algae. I was wondering what kind of measures are being taken to kind of fix this problem, or if that water has to be go through a different process to be, you know, to lower the nitrogen levels and make it safe for consuming. I know it's kind of getting to be a big problem. And then the previous caller mentioned about Monsanto and the GMOs and all that stuff. And I agree with him. I think that there needs to be a whole nother conversation because the development process and the FDA approval, Monsanto did 3 months worth of testing on their genetically modified seeds. And I don't really think you can see that kind of effect on soil or on consumers in a three-month period. Land kind of takes a long time, 10 to 15 years, to show, you know, residual effects of things. And I just wanted to know if farmers are trying to protest against these GMOs, but what's kind of happening with that?
I will throw that one. Thanks very much for the call, Kate, and give Gina the first crack at it.
On the water and the algae bloom and just water runoff. And back to the caller, I think it was Ben, who talked about sustainable mm-hmm. water use. Very quickly, in that Geist area, I don't know what the homeowners, if they have a practice. For the landowners there around the reservoir that have beautiful, immaculate lawns that come from using chemical application in order to maintain their lawns the way they do, part of that runoff, that's what we're seeing. So we really do a good job of regulating farm runoff. We don't do a very good job of regulating homeowner runoff into that issue. And then the other piece of that, that water that goes into the water system, the drinking water system, that goes through, I don't know who manages that, who the utility company is, but that mm-hmm. is a filtration process. Highly managed.
Is that frustrating, Randy and David? Is that frustrating to the two of you? Because Gina's just said here that, you know, the standards that are applied to you guys are higher than, you know, I want to go out and put something incredibly poisonous in my lawn. Very few people are going to care and monitor that.
It can be, but again, it just has kind of become the disconnect between farmers and the non-farming public that don't understand the number of regulatory hoops that we have to deal with. On our swine farm, obviously, you know, we produce hog manure. We have a lot of particular prescriptions about what we can and cannot do to dispose of that. You know, a small city could create a waste treatment plant and then, you know, mm-hmm. be allowed to dump so much, you know, into a body of water. I'm not allowed to create a waste treatment plant on my farm and discharge that into a body of water. If I did, I'd have the EPA at my doorstep in about 24 hours. You know, farmers take the subject of what leaves their farm fields very, very seriously. We want to keep those nutrients in the farm and not downstream.
That'll have to be the last word. I'd like to thank Gina Sheets, Randy Crone, and David Harden for joining me. You've been listening to No Limits. Thanks for being with us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alsett. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.